Brian, welcome to the Hurley Reform Church.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Bob, Reverend Graham, for that introduction, and I thank you also for the invitation to speak today. Before I begin to tell my tale, which is my task today, or that was the invitation, there is some friendly business that I must attend to. When I told the executive committee and our pastor that I would be not at church this weekend because I would be here, immediately they decided that I must bring formal greetings from the Wyckoff Reformed Church, the congregation, to this congregation. So we do send greetings from Wyckoff, New Jersey. Now, maybe taking a little leap here, I'm going to just see if you would like to, by a show of hands, reverse it, and I will send your greetings back to Wyckoff. Is that all right? Thank you. As most of you know, I had a very close call at the World Trade Center 8 years ago. Hard to believe it's 8 years. From a total staff of 285 people in our New York office, our company lost 61 wonderful human beings that day. That's more than one in five of our staff was lost, senselessly slaughtered, in fact. Within our victims' families, 74 children lost their daddy, and one boy lost his mommy, who was his only parent. Many of the 61 who died were people that I had worked with for years. I'd laughed with them for years. And the sadness that they are gone forever will remain with me forever. I'm sure it will stay with me always. September 11 fell on a Tuesday. And on the following Sunday, Reverend Graham, as senior pastor, senior minister at the Wyckoff Reformed Church, invited me to speak at our morning services. And I am grateful to this day for that invitation, because I do firmly believe that that download process began my healing process. Ever since those early days, I have not been filled with guilt about why I survived and why others did not. I'm able to fall asleep without any difficulty. I don't have any disturbing dreams about airplanes crashing into buildings or buildings collapsing. And I know why all of this is possible, and I'm pleased to share it with you today. You see, I know that that is all a gift from God. I take no credit for any of that. Here's the tale. Beautiful blue sky day, cloudless, 8 years ago on September 11, and I arrived on the 84th floor of the World Trade Center where our offices were. We occupied a full floor. We were a brokerage firm that dealt in the wholesale money markets. So we didn't talk to retail customers at all. Our customers were Citibank, New York, Barclays Bank, London, Fuji Bank, Tokyo, and so on. Our president happened to be in London that day, so I felt a responsibility to just make sure the troops were all content at their desks. And I walked through the trading floor with a sweet roll and a cup of coffee, saying, hi, you know, everything's fine. And I got back to my office probably by 8:15. And half an hour later, I was pecking away at my computer with my back to the window, about the same distance as the wall behind me here, on the west side of the Trade Center. And I will just very quickly give you an orientation of that layout. Okay, so you're looking at a map now. And if you can picture in your mind the nine squares of a tic-tac-toe or X's and O's game or a Sudoku game, and think of the numbering of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. The two Trade Center towers were in boxes 1 and 8. Okay, they weren't quite diagonal. That makes sense to you all? Right? North that way, south this way. Okay, so boxes 1 and 8. So at 8:45, I was pecking away at my computer, and my office was on the west side of the south tower. So I'm right in here. When there was this sudden boom explosion noise, and my head jerked up, and the lights above me buzzed for a second, and then suddenly my peripheral vision caught something, and I swirled around right against my glass. 84 stories in the air were swirling flames right against the glass, and there was this flare of heat. And what had happened was, again looking at the map, the North Tower had been hit on the 93rd floor, on the north side, and the explosion had gone right through the building, and the flames had washed out the south side of that tower and had gone right by my window on the 84th floor, 9 floors below the explosion. I thought, incorrectly at the time, that there had been an explosion in our building because of these flames right against my window, and my head had jerked up, and all of that made me incorrectly assume something had happened a couple of floors above us. So I jumped out of my chair, I reached to my overhead credenza, grabbed a flashlight and a whistle, and you say, well, why did you have those so handy? I had been asked to be a volunteer fire marshal on our floor after the 93 bombing. They had asked executives to perform that task in the theory that if the boss says go or stay, that's what employees will do. So I put the whistle around my neck, the flashlight in my hand, and I went out. And I said, come on, everybody, start to move toward the center core. There's been an explosion upstairs. We might have to evacuate. What I didn't realize, of course, what had really happened was next door. And people did start to move, thankfully. And a lot of people in our floor did start to evacuate without the real need at that time to do so. Thankfully, they did. A number of people in our south building here walked to the north windows and could see fairly clearly that something had happened next door. And I'm sorry to report that very quickly, within 5 to 10 minutes, and we're talking now in the period of like 5 to 9 to 9 o'clock, already people were starting to jump because of the heat, the flames, and everything that was where they were. I did not want to take that vision into my memory bank, or have it on my retina. So I stayed back from these north. I went for a walk in our tower to the north windows, but stayed back about 5 yards. A woman, Susan Polio, spun around in her arm, and she came back to me in tears. Oh, Brian, she said, it's terrible. People are dying. And I said, Susan, I know it's a terrible thing. Come on, let's get you more composed. I put my arm around her, and I walked her into the center core of our south tower and left her at the ladies' room at about 9 o'clock. I went back to my office, and I phoned home to tell Diane, and I also called Toronto to tell my father. I called Diane and I said, Diane, something's happened next door. I want you to know we're fine. Turn on the television. There's a developing story. I don't know what it is. And indeed, there was a developing story. She turned on the TV at about 2 minutes after 9, and within, I've got one more little thing to tell you. When I put down the phone, there was an announcement. The strobe lights flashed. The siren gave its little whoop whoop, and a very familiar voice to me, the PA voice, you all know the PA voice, came across and said, your attention, ladies and gentlemen, Building 2, meaning the South Tower, is secure. There is no need to evacuate Building 2. Use the re-entry doors and the elevators to return to your offices. Repeat, Building 2, and the announcement repeated. Diane at home in northern New Jersey turned on the TV, and as she turned on the TV almost, boom, a tremendous explosion happened in the South Tower, and we had been hit from the south side in this direction at about the 78th floor, 6 floors below me. And I don't know much of the rest of the story that happened with Diane at home. I'll throw some snippets that I've heard, but what happened to me was I was standing in an open trading floor area face-to-face with Bobby Call, C-O-L-L, Bobby had gone down 6 or 8 floors, and he was just telling me he'd heard the announcement and come back up in those 3 or 4 minutes, and was telling me that, you know, well, I guess we're okay here, when, boom, our building got rocked. It was this tremendous double thump explosion, and I'm not exaggerating when I say this, in 1 second, our total floor was really destroyed. It was as if you gave a demolition crew a week with demolition equipment to just destroy everything on our floor. The raised floor that we had as a brokerage firm, as you know, up on 6-inch pedestals, 2x2 concrete slabs to hide all the cabling and everything, was now this rocky, cobblestone road. Everything came out of the ceiling, electrical work, the air conditioners, the speakers, the lights, and of course darkness, other than a little bit of light streaming in the windows. In the air was chalky, white, yucky dust that we were sort of spitting out. It wasn't black smoke, and we didn't smell flames or anything like that, but I knew in that instant that it was terrorism. And I will tell you, for the next 10 seconds, it was the only 10 seconds of the day that I was terrified. Another gift that I feel I was given. Because for the next 10 seconds, when our room just more or less exploded or imploded, I went into this athletic ready stance with Bobby right ahead, looking at me eye to eye, and then for this next 10 seconds, the building swayed one way. It went and it went, and I am not exaggerating. I have a technical background, so I can perceive these things reasonably accurately. The sensation, whether it happened or not, I don't know, but the sensation was the building moved toward the Hudson River about 8 feet. It stopped, and it came back to vertical. And from that instant, I knew I was fine. I had this sensation I was going to be okay. I reached in my pocket for that flashlight that I'd picked out 15 minutes earlier, and I shone it around this chalky, dusty construction site room, and gathered up about 7 people that were in that area with me, and we went into the center core. Now, each World Trade Center tower had 2 crossed hallways, and as we passed from the west side to the center core, there was no stairway in that section. The stairways were in the other 3 sections, this north section, south section, and the east section. So we went down this west hall, nothing in it, and as I got to that crossroads, I had a decision to make, but I didn't have the sense to make that decision. What I will tell you is I felt this push, this nudge, and there was nobody there to go left to stairway A. I could have gone ahead to stairway B, I could have gone right to stairway C. I went left to stairway A. And I will tell you, even to this day, there are no survivor stories of anybody descending stairway B or C. Only 4 of us, in the fullness of time, I will tell you, got out through stairway A. But I had this nudge. I don't know what that was about. You can try and figure it out with me. We started down stairway A. I only went down 3 floors, and we came to the 81st floor landing. And as I I'm leading this snake of people behind me with my flashlight. And as I went around this corner, a heavy-set woman was coming up from the 80th floor. She said, "Stop, stop." And she, enormous woman, a tent dress. She said, "Stop, you can't go down. And she was referring to a very tiny man beside her. She said, "We've just come off a floor in flames, and you've got to go higher and get fresh air." And so, and that's about all I heard of that conversation, because my attention was suddenly diverted by this banging noise inside the 81st floor. And I stopped. I sort of dropped. My flashlight is still sort of lighting the area for them to keep talking. And I strained to hear it, and it was this muffled cry. And then I made it out, and it was, "Help, help, I'm buried. Is anyone there? I can't breathe." And it all sort of click, click, and I just instinctively grabbed the person beside me by the shoulder. I said, "Come on, Ron, we've got to get this guy." And the door frame of the fire escape stairway had sort of blown off the wall. We were able to push the drywall back and then sort of sneak sideways through this gap. And Ron and I went in there. And as I went through this gap, I have this very clear memory of all my friends, plus the heavyset woman and the smaller man, turning around and going up. And they all died. In on the 81st floor with my flashlight, now we've got black smoke swirling around, and Ron and I are just very carefully stepping over debris and so on, as this person, about 10 or 15, I can't remember the exact distance, let's say 10, 15 yards away, was directing us with my flashlight. "No, no, no, to your left," that sort of thing. And when I got halfway there, right beside me, Ron, a co-worker of mine, Ron DeFrancesco, was completely overcome with smoke. And I'm going to take, 20, 30 seconds to tell you this part of the story, but this all processed in my mind in that sort of 1 or 2 seconds. But I remember sort of stepping out of the scene and having this strange thought that this stranger, another 5 or 10 yards ahead of us, is saying, "I can't breathe." Ron, my co-worker, right beside me, is completely overcome with smoke, and he left me. He went back to the stairs, and he went up. And around me was this bubble of fresh air, and I cannot explain that in any other word but miracle, because it's inexplicable, because I could breathe normally. He is gagging right beside me. He can't breathe, and I've got a bubble of fresh air. I kept going with the light, and when I got to this stranger, he said, "Can you see my hand? Can you see?" And this hand was suddenly waving in my flashlight about a yard away is when I could finally see something that I recognized. And I went down his light and shone my flashlight in this big face with these big eyes. The stranger is an Indian, an Asian Indian from Guyana, South America. His first words were, after he said, "I can't breathe," and so on, but his first words directly to me were, "Hallelujah! I've been saved. One thing I got to know. Do you know Jesus Christ?" And this was odd. And I stuttered, almost like Peter in denial. I stuttered this, I go to church every Sunday. That was the best I could do to that, "Do you know Jesus Christ?" So I, in my excuse after time, is that I really didn't want to get into a theological discussion in the midst of that chaos. So I said, "Come on, we got to get out of here." And I moved debris away. And again, I'm breathing fine, and he's coughing. And then we realized that there's this wall or something between us, and he's got his head sort of stuck through this wall, trying to do something. I finally stood on a desk, and I went up, you know, maybe 8 feet, and looked down at him, and I said, "The only way out of here is for you to come up this way. Let's try." And he jumped, scrambled like a cat, and I missed him. Second time, up he came, and I hooked under something, his arm or his neck or something, and I heaved him up over that wall, and we fell back on me, and he gave me this great big kiss, and I said, "I'm Brian." And we rolled over and sort of dusted ourselves off, and I said, "Come on, we gotta go home." And he was able to walk. I didn't have to assist him in any way, but his shirt was all torn and everything else. I will quickly tell you his story. His name is Stanley Kramer. He introduced himself as Stanley. I'll tell you 1 minute, 2 minutes of Stanley's story. Back to the map. Stanley's office was on the 81st floor of the South Tower. His office was on the south wall. He had gone, after the first flames had washed by his office, he didn't know where they'd come from. He just saw these fireballs, he called them, going south of the south building. He and his staff went down the express elevator. In the World Trade Center, there were two sky lobbies, one at 78, one at 44, where you transferred from local elevators to express. He went from 81 down to 78, crossed the hallway, took an express down to the ground floor, and was going through the turnstiles when the security guard at, whatever, you know, 5 to 9, said, "Where are you going? This building's secure. There's no need to." He and his co-workers got back on the elevator, went back up. Stanley's the only one of that group that is alive. He went back to his office on the south wall of the South Tower and called, and the phone was ringing as he arrived. He called it was a woman in his Chicago office, and she said, "I'm just calling to make sure you're all gone." He said, "Why? What are you talking about? They just told us our building is fine." She said, "Don't you know what's happened?" He said, "No," because he hadn't seen what had happened in the North Tower. She said, "An airplane has hit the North Tower." And while he's sitting there looking out the window out over New York Harbor, he sees the plane coming across the harbor. And while he's talking to her, it's all going click, click, and he's starting to figure out what's going on. And as the plane got, you know, where when he knew now it was going to hit, he said it was at eye level. At the last moment, it dove down. The right wing went up, the left wing went down. He's a very religious man. He says his Bible was open on his desk. He dove under the desk and he said, "Lord, I'm in your hands now." And the plane dipped and crashed 3 floors below him, but that right wing went through the far end of his office. I don't mean his immediate, you know, 8x10 office. I mean his part of his floor. And the explosion was deafening. He could hear nothing. When he was screaming to me, "Help, is anybody there? I'm buried," what he saw was my flashlight, because the heavyset lady had stopped us on that landing. He saw through the cracks that there was a light there that was sort of moving around. That's what he was screaming at. But he couldn't hear me at all or any of our conversation because of his deafness. So, back to the 84th floor with Stanley. We made our way back to the 81st floor landing, and I pointed my flashlight down. And I just had it in my mind, I want to try. I mean, I don't see flames that the lady was talking about. So Stanley and I started to dig or clear our way through the rubble. The fire escape stairs in the Trade Center were not poured concrete. They were not concrete blocks. They were nothing more than three layers of drywall overlapping each other, fire rated. So in many places, two layers had blown in. Fortunately, all the way down, except right at the 78th floor where the impact was, where the wall was cracked and the flames were sort of licking through the cracks, Stanley and I went by these flames. Didn't dare stick our hand through the slot, but we made our way down on the 74th floor after more digging, most of it just removing drywall, not heavy stuff. We broke into fresh air on the 74th floor. Lights on. The only abnormal condition was there was half an inch of water cascading down the stairs, broken pipes and so on. So at that moment, I knew we were fine. So we kept going. On the 68th floor, we met the only person we would see on the stairway that day. It's a coworker of mine. His name was Jose Marrero. And I want you to remember that name, Jose Marrero. Jose was walking up the stairs. 32 years old, physically fit, handsome guy. I said, Jose, where are you going? He said, I can hear Dave Vera up above on the walkie-talkie. Dave Vera had started down the stairs with me and was one of the people that had gone back up. He said, he's helping people. I'm going up to help him. I said, well, I'm getting, almost as an excuse, I guess, I'm getting this guy from Fuji Bank out. He said, oh, it's fine. I'll be okay. And up he went. And, of course, Jose died that day. Stanley and I continued down to the 44th floor sky lobby that I talked about, the lower of the two sky lobbies. And we went in there trying to figure out what was going on, if we could help, information, please. Deserted. It was like a hotel lobby that runs the whole length of the Trade Center, of the tower. And there was one security guard dressed a bit like me, actually, with his... thought I spilled some water. With gray flannel slacks and a blazer, and he was just a security guard, and he jumped up when he saw us come about the distance from here to the back of the church, and he said, do you have telephones with you? And we said, no, we're not carrying telephones, and continued to walk toward him. He said, oh, my phones don't work. All right, so here's a security guard whose phones don't work on the 44th floor. And he said, but I'll stay with this guy. And he backed up and he showed us this badly wounded man moaning on the ground, massive head wounds, back wounds, semi-conscious. Now, how he got there, how he got those wounds, I have no idea. And sadly, I don't remember the security guard's name or badge number. But he said, I'll stay with this guy as long as you promise to get me, get us a stretcher and a medic up to the 44th floor sky lobby. I said, we'll do what we can. We turned around, went back to the stairs, and continued on down. On the 31st floor, we knew it was a re-entry door, and for some odd reason, we thought we could get a telephone. So we went in. It happened to be Oppenheimer's space. We got into Oppenheimer's conference room. Nobody there, of course, completely deserted, just Stanley and I and that whole floor. Picked up the phone and got dial tone. So Oppenheimer's phone works on the 31st floor. The security guard's phone does not work on the 44th floor, just 13 floors above. I call Diane at home. It's now 9:35, okay, about a half an hour plus a minute or two after the plane had hit. At our home, Pastor Graham, a number of other elders and deacons from our church, some neighbors, and three of our four children had gathered to wonder, what about Dad, Brian, friend, husband, and so on. And when I called home, there was this great excitement in the house, of course. Diane, I told her, I said, I've got a great story to tell you. We're coming home. I put the phone down. I called 911 to tell them about the person on the 44th floor, and Stanley called his wife at her office. Back to the stairs we went, down, down, down. We got all the way to what's called the plaza level. It's the area that views the open area between the two towers. And in shock, we looked at this deserted archaeological site, if you like, all ashen white, not a soul there, when normally there's vendors and tourists and business people and flowers and a fountain. It was a nice people place, but deserted now and ashen gray. And we stared at it for 30 seconds in disbelief, went back down an escalator behind us, and at the bottom of the escalator, which wasn't working, of course, was a security guard, a woman, who said, you can't exit here through Liberty Street or the lobby. You've got to walk through the Trade Center concourse and, find the exit by Sam Goody's Records or whatever it was. So we said, okay. So we walked rather casually, knowing we're fine. Firemen are putting on their gear and didn't seem to be in a panic at all. And remember, we had seen no policemen, no firemen going up those stairs. Not a soul. The only person we saw was Jose Marrero. So we overtook nobody, nobody overtook us, etc. We got to the 4 World Trade Center, one of the lower-lying buildings, where the fireman at the door said, "Hey, guys, if you're going to exit here, you got to run for it." "Well, why?" He said, "Well, there's debris falling from above." I said, "Okay." I said, "Should we look up?" He said, "No, just go for it." I couldn't do that. I opened the door and I checked it. "Stanley, I don't see anything. You ready?" "Yep." "Let's go." And Stanley and I ran for a block and a half. We got to a little deli where the vendors are, the owners are sort of sitting in the covered canopy looking up at the burning towers. And I said, "Have you got any water?" I said, "We've just come down 80-some-odd floors." And he went in, he got some water. He said, "And here, take this breakfast tray, one of those, nice cellophane wrap things with melons and sweet rolls. Take this. Nobody's coming for this today." I said, "Well, thank you." And off we went, Stanley and I walking down the street. Next people we met were two ministers, two priests from Holy Trinity. Is that right? Well, I have lost the name. What's at the head of Wall Street? It is Trinity, yes. That's strange. Wasn't Hurley Reformed, I know that. and this two ministers stopped us, and that's when Stanley broke down. Stanley said, this man saved my life. Well, now the towers are still standing. So did I save his life? Not at that point, maybe not. Put out the fire and everybody's fine. And I said to Stanley, I said, "Well, Stanley, maybe you saved my life." I said, if I hadn't heard your voice in the darkness calling me out of that, maybe you saved my life." And then one of the priests said, "Let's have a prayer." So the four of us in a football huddle had a prayer on Church Street. And the other priest said, "Trinity Church is..." Hey, it did come back to me that time. "Trinity Church is open," he said, "if you want to go in there." And Stanley and I, not sure what the other would think of that, kind of eyed each other, and then we nodded. "Okay, that's a good idea. Yeah, let's do that." So we walked around the south side of Trinity Church, and Rector Street is a sloping street like this, and the cemetery level is above. So as we walked up this hill, gradually the cemetery, in relative to us, sort of lowered. As we walked, and I'm carrying this breakfast tray, Stanley stops, and he turned more than 90 degrees back to look at the two towers. And he grabbed onto the railing of Trinity Church, right by Alexander Hamilton's gravesite on the south side there, and he said, pointing up, he said, "I think those towers could come down." And I said, "There's no way." I said, "That's a steel structure." Remember my technical background. "That's a steel structure. That's just carpets and furniture and drapery," and in mid-sentence, right at the top, boom, 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 this thing started to slide down. And we watched for 8 or 10 seconds, mesmerized, just frozen right there. And then suddenly, Trinity Church acted like a seawall blocking a wave, because that white guck that you've all seen on the TV clips, movie clips, hit the church and exploded upward, up above us. And we realized, well, we had to run or we'd be buried in that stuff. We ran 20 yards up to Broadway, about 50 yards down Broadway as the wave finally caught up to our backsides, and we dove at random into 42 Broadway. I'd never been in that building before. And as we went through the doors and I got into the lobby, this shows you what your mind is doing at times like this, I realized I was still carrying the breakfast tray. Didn't want to be a litter bug, Well, I put it up on the reception desk and opened it up, and all these strangers were there, people I didn't know, and we were all nourished in the midst of that chaos. We all had something juicy and something sweet, and it was fellowship in a strange way. Strange way. Stanley and I talked for 45 minutes while the dust outside slowly settled. And I learned a bit about his family and his history, and he gave me his business card, his personal business card, not his Fuji Bank business card. He and his wife had a little business at home, and I tucked it in my shirt pocket. And we continued to talk. Then we went out the backside of 42 Broadway at about, quarter to 11. That would be 45 minutes after our tower collapsed. And only 15 minutes after the North Tower collapsed, which we didn't know about at the time. And we made our way down New Street, behind Broad Street, behind the Stock Exchange, and somehow we were separated. And we don't understand it because it was not crowded, but suddenly Stanley was no longer by my side. And almost like Tom Hanks in that movie, Castaway, is it? Yeah, and he's yelling, the ball's floating away, "Wilson, Wilson, I'm running up, Stanley, Stanley," wondering where he's gone, and he disappeared. And then this feeling swept over me. that there was no Stanley, that Stanley was just a guardian angel that was sent to get me. And then I reached in my pocket, and there was his business card. So I knew that Stanley was real. It would be quite a story if there was no business card in there. I maybe wouldn't have shared it with you. So I was able to call Stanley later, and we've stayed in touch since. But I made my way over to the East River, and as I was thinking, how am I going to get off this island? I'm walking north on the FDR. I heard this bullhorn in the fog. Next ferry is for Jersey City. Well, that's very strange. There aren't any ferries over here that go to Jersey City, but they had diverted the World Financial Center ferries to the East River, off the Hudson and around Battery Park and up the East River. And I ran down the dock, and as I jumped on this ferry, they closed the doors behind me. I was the last one on that ferry. And we left the dock and went around the bottom of Manhattan, still in this cloud, if you like, and then up towards Jersey City over here. And as we broke into the fresh air, that's when I realized, and most other people on that ferry realized, that both towers were down. And the ferry went dead quiet, dead quiet. We just were all in disbelief how surreal it was to... It was like there was a hole in the sky. I mean, that's the feeling we all had. Got to Jersey City. Because I was the last one on the ferry, I was the first one off. So I ran down the steps and the pier into the ticket office, and I said, "Can I use your telephone?" She said, "Sure." Slid it across. I picked up. Now I'm calling Diane at home. Our phone, and Bob will remember this, and I know Diane and some other friends who were there will remember, our phone just rang constantly. It was crazy that I didn't know this, of course, but it was crazy statistically that I got through. But the phone rang. Now, Diane had been out in the backyard walking back and forth, pacing now for, this would be, it was 11:15, so an hour and 15 minutes after the building had collapsed. She came in to get a glass of water or go to the bathroom or something, but went by our phone as it rang. She picked it up, and I said, oblivious to the pain that she and my family and friends had been suffering, I said, "Hi, you know, it's me. Who else?" And she really didn't speak to me. Because she was stunned, fell away from the phone. Suddenly, another male voice was on it. Said, "Who's this?" I said, "It's Brian. Like, who else would it be?" I said, "Who's this?" And he said, "It's Dave Beaver." I said, "Hi, Dave." He said, "Where are you?" I said, "Well, I'm in Jersey City. I just got off a ferry." And he said, "We'll come and get you." I said, "They're not going to let any traffic in here. I'll just go and get a train." And so, you know, shortening the story here, I walked for 40 minutes up to Hoboken with hundreds of other people. As I walked into the Hoboken train station at 5 minutes to noon, the PA announcement was, the Bergen County train, which was scheduled to leave at 11:30, will be leaving in 5 minutes. So they even held a train for me. By 1:15, it was a milk stop train because, you know, it was an irregular run. They were just stopping at every stop, no express trains on that particular day. I was home on our front yard with a horn blaring as I pulled in the driveway at 1:15. Huge reunion, of course, on our front lawn. Kind of a magical moment, in fact. But the fact that I was home, having been above impact, I was home at 1:15, there were other people that were a mile away from the Trade Center who were stuck on Manhattan for a couple of days because bridges and tunnels and trains and planes and so on weren't operating. So all of that is very difficult to explain. it just whirls by me. So back to some of my notes, because that's really my story, if you like. So in the aftermath, I quickly began to accept that not only had I been saved in a physical sense, but I also realized that I now had some sort of purpose. I mean, why else would this happen, if you like? We'd lost 61 people. The phone just rang nonstop for days. And 4 days, I talked to uncles from Denver of somebody who was at that time still missing, but very quickly people began to realize they weren't coming home, to brothers, to spouses especially, and that went on for days. Did you see Jimmy? Did you see Donna? Where do you think Peter was? All they wanted, some sort of vision of this thing. So I was able to tell them a little bit about my story without embellishing it, without fibbing to them about whether or not I had seen Peter. I'd tell them straight up that I hadn't or I had. And so on. So that went on for a number of days. They were just all desperate, if you like, for information. But I think God was at work healing me as I told my story. And something else happened that was rather big, and I've got to share this with you. Well, two things I have to share with you. Remember I told you about Ron, who went back up? He was with me gagging, went back to the stairs and went up. Ron caught up to everybody on the 91st floor, and he lay down. He said, it was very smoky. People were starting to fall asleep. And he said, within me, I heard not my voice, but another's voice that said, get up. And he said, I knew that I had to see my wife and children. He said, I got up. I went back to the stairway. I went down. He got through the space that Stanley and I guess, had prepared for him. He got through that slot. And as he was exiting way off in the northeast corner by St. Paul's Church, the World Trade Center, one of the lower-lying buildings, he was just going to go through the doors when he heard an explosion. And he turned around, and a fireball was coming down the hall at him. He put his arms up over his face to protect himself, and he got blown across Church Street. Woke up in the hospital 2 days later. He's fine now, but at the time he cracked vertebrae, burned eyes, burned arms. His head had swelled to, you know, quite large. So he's a lucky boy, but he's fine. The other story I have to tell you is about Jose Marrero, who we passed on the 68th floor going up. 9/11 was on a Tuesday in 2001. On the following Sunday, I was able to speak at our church. And on the Monday night following that, I fell asleep. And as I said, from really day one, I've been able to fall asleep rather quickly. I fell into, a remarkable, significant dream. And in my dream, I dreamt that I was lying in my bed on my back with my head up off the pillow, looking at the foot of my bed. That was my dream, which for me is a strange thing to dream, just that I'm in, not that I'm in my, well, yes, that I'd be dreaming about being in my bed is strange, but I also sleep on my left side and my right side, never on my back. So this was an odd pose for me. And to the foot of my bed came Jose Marrero. This is the one that always gets me. He had this beautiful smile, this white, lousy shirt. Now, I only saw him from the hips up. I couldn't see him below, you know, the foot of my bed. He had this big smile. He didn't say a word. There was no flashing lights, no tunnel of lights, nothing like that. Just Jose. And he just nodded with this big smile. And I looked at him accusatory, and I said, Jose, in a very real terms, too. I mean, like, it wasn't like, let's go play, let's go kick a ball around in the park. It wasn't the dream kind of things you would think of. Let's go fly somewhere, anything like that. I was pointing my finger at him and saying, Jose, you're alive. How did you do that? You fooled everybody. He didn't say a word. He just smiled again and nodded. And the message he conveyed to me, without him verbalizing it, the message I absorbed, if you like, was a very casual, you'll figure it out. And I stared at him another second, and then I shut my eyes and shook my head to, is this real sort of thing? And of course, that's when I woke up, and that's when he disappeared. But it was so seamless, because there I was on my back with my head up off the pillow, that I sat up in bed thinking, well, how did he do that? And I looked around the room. And 2 or 3 seconds later, beep, 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 beside me, my alarm went off. And I realized what had just happened. And I have known from that instant that Jose is fine. That my coworkers that are believers are fine. You and I will be fine. And I have just been able to go on with life without any of these guilt feelings. What I'm left with is the following. I do not dwell on the past. There's unanswerable questions. Why me? Why not? Etc. You can't answer those questions. So it's foolish, if you like, to waste time on those things. It's great to have memories of last year's picnic or whatever, but don't dwell on those past problems because they're unanswerable. Don't waste your energy. I know also, looking into the future, that you can't plan it with any certainty. I went to work that day, as did thousands of others, not knowing what would happen. And we all know what happened. So it's great to have plans that, yeah, next week is the picnic. Okay, and we'll hope we'll all show up at the picnic. But, you know, somebody's going to be ill or somebody's going to have a flat tire. You can't count on it being certain. So don't worry about the future. It will unfold as God intends. So if you don't worry about the past or dwell on it, you don't worry about the future, whoop, there you are in the present. And that's where I try to spend a lot of my time, in the present. So I guess what I want to do is make sure you also have that feeling. What I'd like you to do as I close is just take a deep breath and relish the moment and know that you're alive and say that that's a great moment. I'm alive. And live it. Live it. Live it to the best you can going forward. Thank you for listening. Would you like this back? Okay.